welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who got fired from his cushy job at the Umbrella Company when, on a coffee break, he took his eyes off of the satellite images, and somehow Alice and her 2,000 clones were able to escape from a subterranean bunker in the middle of America and somehow make their way all to Tokyo because of the coffee break that he took while not watching Radar. It's John Levingood.
I'm a big guy. I drink a lot of coffee. It took a very long time.
Now, this is going back to the first episode. The coffee and umbrella is good. So we're doing the series. Our first Resident Evil, we established that their coffee at Umbrella was really nice.
I mean, it had to be, especially if you're working down in that subterranean, work world company town thing. Like you have to be. They have to be treating you well on that.
Yeah. And so your one job is to just watch the satellite and watch that bunker, because Alice has been down there for what, 2 years? Because she's freeing all of her clones from the bubbles, and then they all got to get trained. They all have to get matching leather outfits. They have to get guns and swords, tailors, and they're
like, was she teaching them to become tailors?
Yes. And so, I mean, like she could use them as like in a workshop. Like if she starts a fashion line, like in Zoolander, and works with Mugatu, she could use all of them to make clothes. So. So you left like coffee break. You were like, hey, Phil, keep your, they haven't come out of there in 2 years. Just kind of keep your eye on my thing. And then you're like, hey, Debbie. Yeah, just both y'all watch. And you're like, yeah, sure. But Phil and Debbie, they didn't get your back. And during this long coffee break, Alice and her clones just kill about 1,000 zombies and just make their way out of there. And you never reported it. And because of that, the base in Tokyo gets destroyed. Thoughts about this?
It really all happened so fast. Like in hindsight, if you just think of how long the credits were at the end of part three, like, 4 minutes of credits, right?
Yeah.
So you watch those 4 minutes of credits and, to get to the, just to end the DVD. I feel like in that time, that's how long it would really take me to go get that coffee.
Yeah.
So somehow I was like sleeping at the wheel for years. Why? I wonder if I was nervous. You know how like sometimes the head bad guy, yeah, like your Dr. Evil level bad guy, when something goes wrong, he just like unloads like a machine gun and kills like everyone in sight.
Yeah, he just kills like, you immediately. In this one.
I think that I was nervous to identify to Wesker. It's like, Mr. CEO Wesker, by the way, just wanted to say it looks like by my computer system here that I have that's clearly integrated into all of our facilities that's still live over there because it's incubating thousands of Jova clones, right? It seems that she's deactivating these things and there are all these systems up, all these like fifth element learning systems, right? Where she's just touching the screen learning A to Z. So I had a lot of opportunity to point out that things were going wrong. And I have a feeling that it wasn't until like all those little blips of Jova clones, on the other side of the planet were mobilizing into some kind of an airship that I was like, Mr. Wesker, because that's the level of preparedness that we see in the opening sequence of this movie, right?
Now, I have a question though. You didn't go to Wesker. You got one of your supervisors to go to Wesker. That supervisor got shot. And then when you saw that he got shot, you're like, I'm going to take the day off.
Right. I'm going to call in sick.
Yeah. So you were smart enough to send a supervisor in to do the job, right?
Right. Right. Speaking of that, I can't help but to wonder, like, you remember, so we see this Wesker.
Yeah.
Doesn't he look better than the last Wesker?
It's a new Wesker.
It's a different actor.
Yeah, they brought in
This actor has more of like a chiseled jaw. He looks like a fighter. Whereas the last guy, like, he looks like an Agent Smith, kind of tough guy.
Sean Roberts is the new Wesker, and the other Wesker was Monarch from the Glen.
And the last guy, he was like the guy who I bring my tax forms to.
Yeah, he was like, so. But didn't Wesker stab himself with something, and then he's becoming tougher?
Well, yeah, but I mean, he's got traps and broader shoulders now too. So I guess he's somewhere between when Mila Jovovich just gets improved and where the Nemesis guy just turns into a hulking beast. He just got P90X'd.
Because it said 4 years later from the outbreak.
I mean, he could have had a personal trainer. Maybe he got Hugh Jackman's personal trainer that got him in Wolverine shape.
Yeah. Now, I got to ask you a question, John. And as like a supervisor standpoint, I'd love to get an answer from you.
Okay.
Zombies have taken over the world. Skilled humans are at a premium. Like, there aren't many skilled humans who are engineers, scientists. You know, they're zombies now, right? Wouldn't you do your best if you were Umbrella to protect the people working for you? Or would you just let them get slaughtered willy-nilly from a bunch of clones that you don't really even have a war with anymore?
Well, to be fair, if I have facilities that can incubate thousands of clones at once, I might have my senior technical staff in clone form backed up a few times.
Interesting.
Like my Tokyo facility.
But he totally blew up that Tokyo facility.
Well, but I mean, they have facilities all over, though. Remember when they had their hologram meeting in the previous movie? It's like they're all over.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe all these facilities are similar in form and function.
Yeah.
If they are.
So you're saying these are clones? Okay. I guess, you know, I get it. I just felt bad for all these humans getting wiped out because, you know, workers are at a premium.
I mean, what if those workers were clones?
Well, this is like Multiplicity, though, because the clones of Alice weren't as good as Alice.
Right.
So, you know, Umbrella eventually is going to have a bunch of workers who put pizza in wallets and want to kill dolphins.
Who put pizza in wallets? Is that what Michael Keaton was doing?
Yeah, and he wanted to kill a dolphin.
That's horrible. He wanted to kill a dolphin?
So you just got people, you know, banging on radar, doing genetic tests with cheese pizza in their wallets. Well,
but that was from copy of a copy of a copy, right?
But it could get there, right?
I mean, ideally, I'd have multiple copies of my senior staff made from the original. But if the original goes, all right, well, then I'm left with copies of copies.
And then you got to copy that clone, and then you're going to get pizza in a money clip.
I mean, but this is the first time we've ever had a Jova clone infestation.
Yeah, there's been they don't last long.
I'll bet that if we're at our board meeting and I'm like, you know, and I'm looking at you, I'm like, hey, I've got this plan. We've got all these smart senior technical staff from all over. We're going to make 5 clones of each of them from the original, and we're going to put one in each facility. It's like, brilliant plan. We have a backup. Like, no one's going to think that hundreds of Ninja Jova clones are going to come lay waste to all of them. We would never plan that. I wonder how long it takes to make these clones, by the way. If they had 4 years to come over, why weren't there a whole bunch of Weskers to fight back?
Yeah. And why didn't they just put a bomb on that facility?
There are definitely a lot of shortcomings in the technical writing of this storyline.
So we're talking about Resident Evil Retribution, and I want you to know...
Not Retribution, Afterlife.
Afterlife.
The fourth one.
The fourth one.
This goes back to the first episode where we were like, we didn't even know how many of these movies there were.
So I'm gonna kind of talk about the movie a little bit, then I got a bold statement. So Paul W.S. Anderson is back to direct. He did the first one, wrote 2 and 3. Now he's back directing this fourth. They're back in Toronto shooting it. They use they filmed this in 3D. They didn't post convert in the Avatar system that Vincent Pace created. And Vincent Pace, who helped with Avatar, was on set for this film. Their DOP, Glenn McPherson, worked on Rambo, 16 Blocks, The Final Destination. And he's worked with Paul W.S. Anderson on his following movies like The Final Chapter of Resident Evil, Three Musketeers, Pompeii. What I love most about this movie is they use the Phantom camera. And I was first introduced to the Phantom camera when I was working on film sets, and I became obsessed with it because of that movie Melancholia. So just type in Melancholia Phantom camera. It's going to wreck the ending for you, but it's one of the most beautifully shot films of the 21st century.
Now, I never heard of a Phantom camera.
Yeah, the Phantom camera is beautiful. I mean, you can shoot 200 frames per second super slow-mo because it shoots so many frames per second. And so Paul W.S. Anderson is using, in this film, he actually shot half the amount of footage than he has for any of his other movies because setting up a 3D shot is so much more difficult than setting up for a traditional shot. So we shot a lot less footage. You'll see a lot more widescreen on this when you look. So every shot was planned out. It wasn't as willy-nilly. Oh, I think it's pretty interesting. He shot double the amount of footage for Death Race than he did this movie. And what I love about the Phantom camera is just the way they kind of broke it down. So it takes really long to do all the setup. So they put the Phantom camera and the cameras on a techno crane, which is this really sweet crane that can adjust and go high and move and get beautiful shots. They mess with depth of field. They shot in 200 frames per second. So the executioner fight, the Axeman fight, is shot by a Phantom camera. They had massive sets when you watch this movie, which are really cool. And they had rigs of like Scorpio lights, which they could just move up and down to make lighting systems really easy. I know I'm sounding super nerdy, but I really love the technology behind this movie. And I think it's the best looking. And it features my favorite shot. There's a scene where a helicopter runs over some zombies in a wide shot. Or not a helicopter, a plane. Visually speaking, I think sometimes it doesn't mesh, but this is Paul W.S. Anderson really pushing the limits of 3D and Phantom cameras before a lot of movies got on it. So I love that about it. And I guess before we get into it, John, we were kind of talking about this. I was editing the podcast last week, so I guess I am a listener. And I was thinking, what are your favorite four so far? Because I'm going to go out there and say this is my favorite of all of them. Not because of the story, but just because of the way it looks and the filming of it.
I'm a little torn between three and four, because I think they both have a lot of great shots. I think that the maybe more interesting shots are in this one, but I think that this also has some boring shots. I don't like being in that prison, in that building a lot. I don't like the rooftop very much. So it's just a weird balancing act. I feel like the higher highs were in this one, but my more consistent visual pleasure was in the previous one, was in Extinction. But I like three and four, and then after that, probably one and two at the bottom.
I think I watched three too many times. So right now I'm at 4, 1, 3, 2.
We agree two is at the bottom.
Two, like I want to do 4, 1, 3, ... 2.
Yeah, it's tough, the placement of one as well, just because, I mean, conceptually, I want to put number one as like I want to make it more like the second in line out of the four, but just in terms of just fun movie enjoyment, rewatchability, it's not quite, but if I disliked any of them, it's number two.
Yeah.
It's like, let's just be clear. I'm saying one is my second to worst out of four, but it doesn't mean I don't like it.
Like this movie though, so I think three is the worst written, but I like it much more than two, and on some days I like it more than one. Four, if you think about it, it falls apart like one of the Avengers at the end of Avengers Infinity War, just like ashes in your hands. Because there's some things in this movie and I'm like, wait a second.
We just discussed basically the premise of starting the movie and how that doesn't really seem to work.
And there's a couple times in this movie I'm like, I don't get it. I don't understand it. And so I do the research, and there's a lot of stuff from the video game, but none of it's really explained. But maybe I'm just a sucker for the – I'm a huge Phantom camera nerd. And so just being on – you know, I've been on set with like these cool techno cameras, and a lot of the lighting grids he was talking about I was familiar with in big stages. And I think that's why I like it, because I really felt like Paul W.S. Anderson, despite some of the major plot holes – really tried to make a visually inventive film in this one.
And we can have fun picking at the plot, but at the end of the day, this is a Resident Evil movie, and that's not why any of us are here.
yeah, it's fun. Like, I guess you could sit around, like, I think we were talking about this. Like, you got to get on the wavelength of these movies. Otherwise, you'd just be like, honest trailer, CinemaSins. Like, oh, they didn't do that. They didn't do that. Like, these movies have a very distinctive storytelling style, and you just have to get used to it and kind of embrace it.
I really have found, and I feel like I've said this in every episode of this is now our fourth Resident Evil episode, but each of these movies we've been watching, I feel like I have enjoyed more every single time I've watched it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just find myself liking them more and more and more as I can tell. People are like, oh, if you set your expectations too high, you'll be disappointed. So if you set your expectations low, you can enjoy it. I don't even mean like that. It is more like what you said. It's more wavelength than it is even setting expectations. It's the mood of the mania.
Yeah.
of these movies. And yeah, I like them more and more every time. I was reading my own review that I wrote last year of this movie. And at the time I thought this was the worst of the first four Resident Evil movies. And now I put it as tied for the best with Part 3.
Yeah.
Just look at that. Like, it just, my opinion changed. That's dramatic.
I was very excited to get, and I was sending you messages during the second one. Like, I can't wait to get to 4. Because four in my head is when I felt like it really went off the rails, and just went to bonkers towns. But it really didn't go to bonkers towns. It's kind of similar to the other three.
What's interesting is that in scale, if you were to just look at it, all the sites where this takes place, it seems like it's gone global. But the reality is that most of this movie takes place in a prison building and then on a ship that was basically within sight of the roof of the prison building.
Yeah, like, yeah, the short scene in Tokyo where she goes and battles Wesker.
That was basically like Blade 2 meets The Matrix.
Like, with all their satellites, how did they not see them coming? Oh, because you were getting coffee. And then your supervisor got killed and everyone just forgot about it.
For years.
Yeah,
for years. For years.
I love the end of the third one, "We're coming for you." And then they should just do "years later."
Right, years later. But we always talk about the voiceover too. This voiceover, it almost sounded like Alice was getting tired of doing voiceovers at the beginning of each movie.
Yeah, the third one she was very chipper.
This one she sounds tired, like she hasn't slept.
Yeah, just
your Diary of the Dead.
This is how it opens. It's like you that one time when I asked you to jump on a line or something. At a Comic-Con, he made that noise. Or Napoleon Dynamite. The world is still going to crap. And we're attacking Tokyo. Wesker gets away. He turns me into a human. I fly to Alaska. In a really beautifully shot film, I see Claire Ellie Larder from the third one. She's a feral animal, but she has some bug on her chest. I take that bug off of her chest.
Which is never mentioned again until the stinger at the end.
She loses her memory. So then she and I are on this plane together, and like we're kind of bantering, and then I see this big building, and then there's a zombies, 10,000 zombies surrounding this building, and then I land on top of it, and that's where we're at.
So by the way, when she's coming around to land that plane, remember she does the first flyby? Like, was she just hoping that someone on the roof of that plane of that building would be like, we need to set up one of those Top Gun reels to keep the plane from falling off the edge when it lands? Like, that was a very hypercognitive connection to make. Like, that dude must have been working the surface of a naval carrier,
yeah,
at some point to have thought to do that. And if she thought, I wonder if someone over there is going to think to do that. She took a big risk.
Yeah, she relied on them. And it paid off. I mean, they had one built.
Right, pretty fast.
Now, a couple quick questions, a couple quick things for you. Paul W.S. Anderson said he took away Alice's power because she was becoming too powerful, and they wanted her vulnerable again because it's like, where do you go from there? Her outfit is inspired after a cyberpunk Amelia Earhart, and one night she and Paul W.S. Anderson were watching TV, and they learned of a thing called a butt bra. And Mila Jovovich is like, I need to have a butt bra for this movie. So the outfit, when she's walking, you'll see that she has a butt bra. And that's from Mila, because Mila wanted to have that.
So she has two outfits in this movie, and both of them, I said this last movie, her outfits get consistently more tactically sound movie.
She's a cyberpunk Amelia Earhart in this one.
Like, yeah, well, or a leather-clad ninja in the beginning. Right.
Oh, yeah. Like, she went stealth in the beginning, then she became cyberpunk Amelia Earhart.
Right. And that beginning, I feel like the beginning was very strongly influenced by the Trinity Neo rescuing Morpheus from the office building because they're shooting, you know, the concrete pillars that look cool. You know, she's jumping and running off the walls. It was loads of fun. And then, you know, just the humming of her katanas crossed with all the bullets raining down in slow motion. And you hear all like the clink, 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 clink. Like I think they were having a lot of fun with that scene, but that was really fun.
Oh yeah, when she showed up with all her clones, and then like one of them died, and you're like, what?
And you're like, end of the movie.
Yeah, and they shot in a Toronto university. Those pods they were in are real, which is kind of cool. Like students get to study in those things. But yeah, I'll go for it.
I was just gonna say, even starting with that scene, I think that I liked the overall action stunts more in this movie than any of its predecessors in the franchise.
You know what? I wonder why, because they with 3D, they didn't have the option of really slashing it up. They kind of had to shoot to cut, so nowhere to cut, so they had to shoot less. So maybe they thought about the fighting more and had better villains, not just like a giant thing swinging.
You did mention more wide angles, too. I like that. I don't like really choppy cuts, which was my least favorite thing about the final fight with the Nemesis monster in part two. It was like every swing of a punch was a cut.
Yeah, so maybe they had to draw them out longer. They had to plan everything out much more for this, because I like the action a lot more. And you know what I liked? I'm jumping around a little bit, but the people in this movie, some of the core characters who are alive at the end, they're very tactical. They're good with guns. They shoot for the head. They seem like the main ones, not like the fodder. But it seemed like watching a bunch of very good people at what they're doing do a job. And I kind of enjoyed that.
Especially if doing a job is being a douchebag. I like Kim Coates' character.
They go in Toronto. Wesker escapes, takes her power. She goes to Alaska. She brings Claire. They land at this prison. And on this prison, there's several characters. So there is let's see. There's Boris Kojo, who plays Luther. There's Kim Coates, who's Bennett. Then you have, she's not there yet. Sergio Perez, Manchata, Angel. And then Casey Clark, who is Crystal Waters in the movie, and she dies in water. But they've been here for like 4 years, right? And so this guy has been a producer who's just been a jerk for 4 years. Hey, I'm a producer for 4 years.
He's still rushing his way to the front of line like he's the biggest guy in the prison yard, the first to get his food.
And there's a scene where Boris Kojo, Luther, yells at him, like, gets really mad, like, this piece of crap. And I'm like, man, that's aggressive. But if you've been living with a guy who hasn't changed for 4 years and you haven't killed him, I mean,
I'm calling that a writing flaw, by the way. I feel like in their first 3 months in there, I think Kim Coates, the Hollywood exec, would have gotten his nose broken and he would have been less vocally douchey.
For 4 years he's been like, or for years he's been like this.
I think his nose would have been cracked really soon. If we were in that building with him, his nose would be cracked really fast.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, why are you talking to her like that? She makes our food every day. Like,
4 years of it.
Everyone's just taking it. But what do they think? Like, maybe we'll need him. It's like, that is exactly the kind of person who gets people killed in these movies. That's that guy. That guy when everyone's like, we all need to be a cohesive unit because if we all don't get out of here, we're short a man and we need that man. Whereas he's like, I got a chance to get out of here alone. I'm going.
After 4 years.
I mean,
like 4 years of this guy. Years. I don't know four, but years.
It's a...
You're right. His nose would have been crunched.
Multiple times. His nose would have been crushed so many times, you'd think that he met Vince Vaughn from Cell Block 99. His face would be so smushed.
So he's like so... That means everybody in there, they're good people. Like, they're very patient. They just kind of deal with this crap, and they don't kill him. But they, you know what they do to get away from him, John? Is they light torches all day. There's many torches in this prison.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about that, too. I don't really know what the dynamics of that would be. Where are they getting all that stuff to light all those torches all this time?
Yeah, I'm probably getting kerosene from something. And then you really have to light the 3D because they filmed in such big areas, so they didn't have power. So they're like, well, we need to light it. So, like, let's just over-torch it. Which, I don't know. I mean, I'd rather have over... Give me something to do during the day, right? And I'm going to go light.
No, I just mean, like, where are they getting all that wood?
I'm going to go light 70 torches, guys. I'll be
back. They are in L.A.
No, they're in a prison, a very large building. So maybe they've just been slowly kind of taking it apart.
Why is that prison in the middle of downtown?
I never thought about that.
It's got a view of the water, and it's in the middle of downtown. By the way, why isn't it in a desert? Because the narration and what we saw in part three would have suggested that an area like this is an overrun desert. Why were the forests in Alaska not turned to deserts? Why didn't they die like allegedly all the forests did in part three?
No thinking, John. Turn away. Turn away, sorry, John. Turn away. Turn pull back. In the words of Michael Pena from Ant-Man, back it up. But back it up. We're doing it. Back it up. And also, why are the zombies... I know that zombies became a genies in Resident Evil 5, but why did the zombies transmorph into running, spitting, tentacled zombies?
They have, like, predator octopus mouths. So, and I think that's also the Blade 2 motif.
Yeah, so they became Blade... They basically, like... So in the I was like, what are Magini? So I read about it on the Wikipedia, and they're smart zombies who can drive cars and stuff. These zombies were dumb. They were just fast and could do the mouth thing. And they can dig through concrete. They can dig through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet of concrete.
So I was thinking of that, by the way. Even if that was soft earth, that is a very smart decision for a zombie to have made.
They don't, and they dug underneath a drain pipe, right?
Let's get the schematics. We need to come. It's like, it's the way the soil is softer over here, so we're gonna dig through here.
Vinny, get me a pickaxe. Like, they had no tools, John. How are they getting earth? How are they digging concrete? Are they Shawshank Redemption?
Bony nub. Right, they're just shaking it out while they're playing baseball at lunch.
Yeah, that's right. Are zombies going in with little helmets? Right, little tunnel and helmets with flashlights, little buckets, little trash, you know, like the little lunch pails.
Picturing zombie minions.
Yep.
Despicable.
I mean, are they just digging? Did they find dwarves? Like, do they have zombie dwarves?
Did they find a blueprint? Did they go to the like some public records to figure out where to dig? Yeah,
and so they have dug. All right, so I guess we'll rewind here. They're in the place, and they've met the crew. They've met the jerky producer. They met Cool Luther. Then it turns out that there's a guy named Chris, who is Claire's brother, and he's played by Wentworth Miller, who I liked in this movie. I thought he was good.
He's the prison break guy,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, prison break guy. And he is in a very Hannibal Lecter-esque prison cell, which Paul W.S. Anderson said he did on purpose because he likes that movie, and they analyze everything. And, oh, they also gave Alice a six shooter because they wanted to be like a Western star. But also Paul W. Anderson hates producers, so that's why he made the producer a jerk. I guess I should sum that up, but if you didn't know that,
is that what Kim Coates played, a producer?
Yeah. And so
I for some reason I thought he was like a talent agent.
And homeboy Paul W. Anderson, those commentaries are always like digging on Hollywood, so that was like, you know, take you know, eat it Hollywood producers. Well, Melancholia, I get lost on tangents. So they're in the prison. They meet Wentworth Miller. He's in a cell. They went to free the prisoners to battle zombies, but then he got thrown in there with seemingly a lot of food because he was in there for a long time. But he's Claire's brother, but Claire doesn't remember anything because Allie Larder doesn't remember anything.
So that seemed pretty meaningless to me that they were siblings.
Yeah, I guess in the video game they're siblings.
Okay, that makes more sense to why they do that.
And based on a 1 in a trillion probability, they find each other at a prison in downtown Los Angeles.
And more like a 1 in a trillion possibility, there is a maximum security prison in the middle of downtown Los Angeles.
I want to meet the private contractor who pulled that off.
Like it is the same contractor who made the prison from that Sylvester Stallone movie.
Yeah, Escape Plan.
Escape Plan, that's right.
And Face Off.
Oh, so super prisons.
I do got to say one thing. During the commentary, Paul Anderson was making a joke about how Mila Jovovich is always like, if Umbrella put as much planning into taking over the world and preventing the zombie plague as they did in their structure building and interior design, like, the world would be a safe place. Because in this movie, they have some very elaborate and labyrinth facilities that are well guarded. and they don't really track. Well, it was your fault because of the coffee, but I mean, they made some pretty big technical problems, but their structures are beautiful. Well, the prison isn't one of them. I'm just saying in general. I just had to go off on a tangent.
Well, we got to go back. When we're talking about how well guarded it is, it's more like they're well geared. It's like you got all these goons and you give them 5,000. Oh God, I'm undercutting it. You give each of them $5,000 worth of guns. They're probably wearing $10,000 to $15,000 worth of stuff. Give them a six shooter and $5 worth of shooting lessons, and they're going to be better off.
Hey, that was like my commando post where they missed 3,000 bullets because they were a cut rate militia using cut rate weaponry without a gun range.
That's like what happens here, except they have like super duper guns and super tactical SWAT gear, like this riot gear. It's like, why are you putting like a 12-year-old in a suit of armor and giving them like the future gun if they don't know how to use any of this stuff?
Yeah, if you're just starting drinking wine, you know, don't give me a $5,000 bottle.
You just be like, yeah, man, it'll get you drunk.
Yeah.
Sam well, Jackson.
Some sommelier is just sitting there going,
oh, dear.
Oh, dear. All right, so they're in this prison. The Magini are digging into it. Claire, Ellie, Larger's brothers in a prison cell.
Was that word Magini used in the movie?
Yeah, they're from Resident Evil 5. So they were inspired from that. And he kind of wanted to make these different zombies. And so they're stuck in there. We're kind of learning more about the characters. Mila is still using a very monotone speaking voice. And so she learns that there's a shower, right? And she's in there. There's a guy creeping. But he gets killed by the dudes who have done the smartest tunnel on the planet. And then we learn that there is a giant with an axe.
Dude, there is a Silent Hill executioner out there.
Yeah, and he's called the executioner. And I want to know who did his tailoring, because did Umbrella create him?
Apparently. It had to be.
Did they make his axe?
His Final Fantasy axe? His Soul Calibur axe?
That's a custom axe.
I feel like when he swings that, if he misses, his feet will leave the ground. That looked silly big. That really was like Soul Calibur, like Final Fantasy big.
Now, in the video game, he was from another continent. So did he?
Who was the monster?
Yeah. Did he travel from another continent, or do you think they just yada yada'd it and he was in LA?
They might have just like brought him over in a tugboat from Wesker's naval carrier.
Like the T-Rex.
Like a T-Rex, yeah, like chained down.
And then somehow it kills everyone on the boat, lands in L.A., and starts walking towards the building.
It probably came from, like, Stuttgart, where, like, their, you know, Victor von Frankenstein research leader came up with combining a whole lot of bodies into one huge body.
Did it nail the nails into itself, or did a researcher do it?
I think Silent Hill did it. So I swear this is a Silent Hill thing.
He stepped into another war. Oh, it's in the comic. When I say comic, it's
the
video game. Yeah,
the video game.
Because we're so used to talking about like Marvel movies.
By the way, I've never played a Silent Hill game or a Resident Evil game. When I say Silent, it's just that I saw the movie Silent Hill. I'm just saying Silent Hill.
That's a triangle head.
Yeah, pyramid head. Pyramid head. That huge cleaver thing.
So is an intern doing this, or do they hire a guy who's good at nailing stuff into people's bodies?
I'm more concerned with the decision-making process that led to the putting the big nails in the head.
Were they necessary?
I mean, was it what, or was it like we need to give them some very precisely knocked down brain damage, because if he's too smart, he'll be a problem. Got so it. We're like it's like the equivalent of a lobotomy, except they're aiming for different parts of the brain.
Could he have picked this up from other fights?
I get that's a, who what's he fighting?
Like, yeah, there's no one left.
Someone with a giant nail gun.
Yeah, did he pick a fight with someone at Ace Hardware that was holding
like someone
there?
Who has like a Gatling gun that shoots railroad spikes?
Yeah, is he battling them?
I mean, maybe. I feel like King Kong threw him through a hardware store for giants.
So he has a custom axe, right? We're agreeing to that.
Oh yeah, that was made for him. That no one else was using that before we had giant executioners.
So we have our main characters, they're in the prison. Claire's getting her memory back. Everyone's kind of planning on a way to escape, right? Because there's tunnels. But the problem is the Magini are clocking in 9 to 5 and tunneling holes, and then the executioner is banging on the gates with his axe.
If our protagonist knew as much about the floor plans as the Magini did, they would have escaped faster.
Yeah. And so, okay. So, all right, how about this? Let's, my brain's exploding because I'm thinking about floor plans. Let's take a break.
Did you get plus size railroad spikes impaled in your head?
Yes. I'm feeling like the executioner after he got thrown through the giant hardware store by King Kong. So let's take a break. I'm going to regroup. And when we get back, we're going to talk about more floor plans. Bye. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I've got it all together, folks. I'm there. I'm hip. I pulled it all together.
You got those nails out of your head?
I did the floor plans. I pulled the nails out, and I'm here. I'm not flummoxed anymore. Until we start talking about it again, then I'm screwed. But before we jump back into it, we gloss over some listener questions. We have two listener questions we want to get to. The first one is from Tom, and he asked, did they find the afterlife? I'm seriously asking because I don't remember.
So my impression, and I didn't think of this until he asked this question. Before that, I'm just like, they may as well have called it afterthought. The subtitle to the sequel never mattered to me until he asked. And I realized, I guess the afterlife was in that early action sequence at the end of the Jova clone invasion, when Wesker is escaping in his super special helicopter thing and true Mila Jovovich, true Alice, original Alice, sneaks in on there to try and execute him. And he gets her with the anti-serum or whatever and kills all of her T-cells.
Yeah.
And now she's normal. I feel like that is the afterlife. It is her life after infection with the T-virus. That's what I got.
Well, that's deep.
But again, I never thought about, I've seen this movie multiple times now. I never thought, why do they call it afterlife? I'm just like, yeah, whatever. It's a clever, snippy sounding subtitle.
I was thinking because the third one was extinction. So everything's dead. So then the next one's like afterlife.
Oh, that works too. I didn't think of that.
I wasn't thinking.
I like yours more.
I wasn't thinking heaven. I was just thinking everyone's dead. So after.
Right. Like this is our figurative afterlife. Yeah.
What do you think?
I like that too. I actually like that more because it goes with the subtitle, because it makes the subtitles work better with each other. Because you had apocalypse,
yep,
which led to an extinction. Mm-hmm. And then when everything's extinct, you go to afterlife.
Yeah. And then the right? retribution.
Well, you know what? I think they should have called it then instead of retribution, revelations.
Oh, revelations. Yeah.
Right.
Ooh,
right. Because then it would be like the heavenly war of the greater powers or something.
Holy crap.
And we should have been subtitling these. You should have been marketing this.
And then
if you were talking about the subtitles when they were, you know, on like Good Morning America, when they're talking to like Mila and Paul about their movie that's coming out, you know, like what on the Today Show and stuff, you're like, oh yeah, it's called this. Like, oh wow, why is it called this? Well, da 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 da. And everyone would be like, whoa.
That's right. Blow minds.
I'm telling you. What I'm blown with is that we're getting into this deep pithy explanation of extinction to afterlife. Not a whole lot really happens in afterlife.
Yeah, this movie, nothing happens, right? Well, something happens. Well, no.
We fly to Alaska to bump into a friend. We immediately fly back to L.A. We get trapped in a building. We leave the building. We see a ship. We get on the ship that was 2 miles from the building, and then we're on the ship.
Yeah, and then we fight one guy, and then we're back to square one.
We're back to where we started at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Kind of.
Like, in a way. but that's interesting. I never thought about afterlife. And I never would have put together extinction and afterlife. And then apocalypse, extinction. That makes sense now.
Oh, I hate
that. That is the best writing of this franchise now is linking together the subtitles to the sequels.
Did I tell you that I got annoyed when I realized, because I watched these movies by 3 years apart from each other, so I thought none of them made sense in regards to each other.
But it's the Saw paradox. It's the Saw franchise paradox.
But the more you watch them, you're like, these make sense. There's a narrative.
They do.
There's a through line.
And it's interesting, too, that, again, like the Fast and the Furious movies, they know there's going to be a sequel before this movie even hit theaters. Because they filmed the scene at the end of every single one of these movies that's like, see you in the sequel.
Yeah. They're really, like, they have, I mean, these movies aren't very expensive and they make tons of money overseas. So maybe they even knew it.
And I'm not going to say what it is because we're not there yet. But this movie actually had a post-credit stinger to reiterate the "see you in the sequel" before the credits. Like this franchise is the champion of we're going to have a sequel if we want it.
Yeah, I mean, six of them.
But ever since part one, every movie ends with a very obvious. It's not even like they left it open to a sequel possibility. It's like they all but put a sign in front of you that said, see you with the sequel.
And each final shot leads exactly into where we're going next.
Right. Yeah. They stay true to it, even though these films are two and three. And eventually, I think between this one and Retribution is at least 3 years.
Yeah. Because this one was 2010.
Okay, Retribution is 12, so just 2 years.
Oh, wait, 17. And then, so then 5 years went by.
For the last two, yeah, between the last two.
Wow. All right, second question. Buddy from New Jersey, how did the CGI dogs manage to act with a better range of emotion than the main character? I love Mila in Fifth Element, and honestly, not much else. She's great in Perfect Getaway.
She's wonderful in Perfect Getaway.
She's funny in Zombie. She's in a movie called Stone where she puts in good work. I mean, I just think she made a decision with this character. And, I mean, it is very, she's very serious in this movie.
I'm going to agree with one part, and that's that a lot of Mila's movies are weird. She did that weird hotel movie that came out like 10 or 12 years ago with all the junkies and criminals in it. I can't think of what it was called, but she picks a lot of these weird roles, some interesting indie films, some weird straight to video stuff that, and they're odd characters. And so like, I get that stuff, but nothing can touch Fifth Element. That was like just wonderful perfection, innocent, unique character. Right. But like, I like her in these movies. The first one or any of them, they're no, you know, film auteur work, but I like her in them. She is driving this franchise.
Yeah. And so the first one, she kind of lost her memory, so she's in a haze, right? Learning her powers. The second one, she has work done on her and she can't stop. She's just fighting to stay alive. The third one, she kind of has to alienate herself from everyone because she could kill everybody. So she's by herself at all times. And then in this fourth one, she's been alone for years. So she's not just going to be like, she's like Mad Max. Like, they just grunt. They don't talk much. Like, she's not going to be like, what's up? You know, she's not going to be high-fiving people. Like, she's just going to be all business.
And she has good screen presence, I think.
Yeah.
Like, she has good screen
presence. Oh, no, she holds the screen well.
The part of Buddy's commentary that I also agree with is that, is because I think he only saw the first movie, by the way, is the dogs. Because, and we've talked about this. The dogs in the first movie was such a great scene. It was such a great buildup, like kind of, not to use it in a negative way, but just a good buildup of gags.
Yeah.
You know, like that was just awesome. I mean, that was a trailer moment too, as I recall, when that movie was being marketed, was the dogs.
And it's definitely the gag, as you call it, because I was reading a Bruce Campbell book where he's like, yeah, we got to do this dog gag. And I was like, is it a joke? But like, gags are like bits or sets or scenes or fights.
So yeah, not meant to be like a joke.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Like, so like, I don't think the dogs have that much personality in the first one. I just think the way they built the scene is funny.
Right.
And it's just, things keep getting worse for her, and the way they built that is very smart.
And to lay Buddy's comment on equal ground, both the dogs and Alice have been in every movie.
Jeez Louise. These are the
so far anyway.
These are
so far
Blade 2 dogs.
Dude, there's so much Blade 2 going on here. There's a lot of it's all in good fun. I liked it when we did meet these dogs. But are we gonna talk about the shower fight with the executioner?
Did the water scene come before or after that when she's with Wentworth Miller and they gotta swim in the water and that water girl gets killed?
I don't know.
Because I just watched this yesterday. My only point is I like underwater scenes in horror movies that take place underwater. That was my whole point.
I wasn't too big on this one, to be honest. I thought the zombies swam too fast. They were like Mako sharks.
Yeah, they were like the ones from Deep Blue Sea.
And then when they were rushing out of the water, almost like coming out of the graves, it felt like, except at a fast pace. That was exciting, but it was just exciting for me. That didn't have a lot of presence for me, other than the excitement of moving the film along.
I like the movement. I like how efficient Wentworth Miller and Mila were when they were killing the zombies. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So
she's very skilled in this. They did a good job showcasing her in this.
It's all butt bra.
It's all the butt bra. I need a butt bra. I need to keep this under control.
So I'll tell you what though. I love, the bathroom fight. So the gates come down, all the Maginis come rushing in. Somehow the executioner takes him and his axe up a stairwell, right?
And through doorways.
And
this thing's huge.
Sneaks up on four people. And he slices a red shirt in half. And what follows next is a battle between the axe man, the executioner, and Allie Larder and Mila.
Which has to begin with them dodging his swings and him hitting and bursting major water mains.
Major water mains. And what I liked a lot about this, they were, you know, these cameras are capable of doing 1,000 frames a second, like watch Melancholia. But in this one, they're doing 200 frames per second. And just the crispness of it, and I would love to actually see it in 3D. Because just the way they play it in slow-mo, I thought Allie Larder pulled off the action hero vibe really well. Oh, and I gotta say, when the executioner was battering down the doors, Allie Larder and Claire and Luther were out front, and Claire's just like, shoot the idiot in the head. And Luther tries to shoot the thing in the head, and it doesn't kill it. So I like that bit at least. Like, they're like, yeah, just shoot it in the head, let's be done with it. So that's another smart, like, tactician thing. So the fight breaks out. I don't know, I kind of liked how Mila got knocked out of it. The way he missed with the downswing, but then he threw it to the side and bonked her. I thought that was a pretty wise move by the executioner.
I'd say that would have killed non-T-virus Mila.
Yep, absolutely. He bonks her.
This is an action movie, and that's okay.
He knocks her unconscious, nothing breaks. And then you just have Claire in slow motion.
Sliding
everywhere, battling the executioner, who is...
And you can, like, follow each drop. If you have, like, I have a 75-inch 4K TV. I could like, put my finger on any drop of water on the screen and follow it down.
With the 3D, with, you know, the way they filmed it, the rig that they had. I mean, it looks beautiful, the way they shot it. It's a little clunky for sure, but, I mean, this is a guy who's really trying to make a cool fight.
For me, it was clunky in terms of the movement of the giant executioner.
Yeah.
But it really was like watching the bull in the china shop. The china shop is gorgeous. All the scene is gorgeous. Everything that's happening in the scene is really crisp and cool looking. But what that executioner was doing was the most boring thing about the scene for me.
Yeah. And I,
like, Allie Larder sliding was cool,
yeah,
but him swinging in slow motion, it's like, he's so big, it already looks like it's damn near slow motion.
I do like that the first thing that Alice does when she sees it is just spin kicks it in the face.
Right. Like, that'll do anything with
that's
your
pretty awesome.
with your unvirus modified matrix skills.
That's how I want to take care of people, is just spin kicking them in the face. But the good thing is, since there are so many pipes.
She's lucky. She could have broken her ankle like when Deadpool kicks Colossus.
Oh, she could have pulled like a – she could have gotten her foot stuck on a nail.
On a nail! Oh.
Just hangs there.
Imagine
that'd be so awesome. Holy
she's
crap.
Running in slow motion and she's dangling there,
just She's hanging from his head. Get off of me, lady.
That is terrible.
So she's sliding all over the place. The frame, you know, the shot looks beautiful. The Fana camera is doing beautiful work. And the one thing is, since he's so big and since he has a huge axe, there is a lot to get in the way of him. So he can't really have that much mobility, even though he did sneak in there. But I do like how he gets killed. He just gets his head blown off with bullets full of quarters. Like, I like that his head exploded. But that doesn't make sense, because a bullet would have just killed him. You don't need to explode his head.
Yeah, I don't know why the quarters were more effective in her sawed-off shot. I don't know. But whatever.
It looked good in 3D.
It's fine. Maybe that was just like he got shot enough times in the head that was just where his skull was ready to crack. Like, you know, there's some structural integrity stuff maybe going on here.
I don't know. I liked it, though. I liked the look of it. And it's so much better than it was in Apocalypse. I thought the big guy was handled much. The thing is, when you have references of the other movies, you're like, oh, well, this is better than that scene. So I don't hate it. Like, so I don't dislike it. Like, they're making improvements. So the good news is the Axeman is dead, but the Maginis are attacking, and Homeboy, jerky producer, kills one of the nice guys and takes off in the plane. So they're stuck.
First chance he got. First chance he got. He's like, I can get the hell out of here.
Yep. He's going to the boat, which is going to save everybody. Luckily, they have the Magini tunnels, so it's Claire, Chris, Mila, or Alice, and Luther. Luther gets pulled away from zombies. Don't worry, he lives at the end. I like that character. So then it's Claire, Chris.
So was he an ex-athlete who was then, like, just on that billboard, like high-end Rolex ad?
Yeah. Like, soccer players do that, like Ronaldo and a bunch of...
Did they say what sport he played?
They did not. So it's they never tell you.
We just know he's an athlete. He's like, because he says, like, are you into sports?
No, he said football or – he said a sport.
I thought he just said, like, oh, you don't recognize me? You're not into sports? I thought that's
– badminton.
I thought that was – badminton?
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Let's make him a badminton
How
here.
Amazing. Like, they just throw that line in there, like, professional badminton player, 2 gold medals, won the national championship 7 years in a row.
And then someone looks at him, like Kim Coates will look at him and be like, you need a body like that. It's like, oh, you need serious endurance and like VO max for that.
I mean, have you watched it? Like, have you seen the athletes?
Those guys go nuts.
Yeah,
they go nuts.
Yeah, the hand speed coordination's insane.
It's like watching Bruce Lee play ping pong with nunchucks.
Badminton. And then you just leave it. And then you're sitting there going, this is a random aside, but I was talking about how in A New Hope, you're in the theater in 1977. You're watching it when the door goes up and the stormtrooper walks it, bonks his head on it. Like, you couldn't rewind it. You had to go back to the next showing. So you're sitting there and the VHS.
Are you like, did that just happen?
Yeah. And you can't go back for a week. Like, the VHS you won't get for a year. And so you're sitting there and you're like, did he just hit his head on that thing?
I have an aside of your aside.
Yeah.
So everyone loves me. This is an historic, like, little error that people love celebrating, right? It's like that's a part of any Star Wars drinking game, probably, right? That head bump.
Yeah.
But, like, in reality, right, soldiers or not, you're going through the motions of life. Something like that's just going to happen. Like, that's just a normal thing that happens.
Yeah. And the door didn't go up all the way. The door didn't go up all the way because they shot it, and so it probably malfunctioned and only opened 3/4 of the way.
But, like, if you were wearing, like, a helmet, like in Forrest Gump, right, you know, those helmets, they're the Starship Troopers helmets. At some point, as you're just going through the motions of daily life, you're going to bump that thing into something by accident. That's just going to happen. It's going to get stuck on a branch. It's like, that would just happen.
I have a triple aside.
Okay.
I had a straw hat that I bought when I was a stand-in on Jane Mansfield's car, and I had it for about 4 years all the way through. I worked on Million Dollar Arm. And – you know, I'm 6'3", and so when you have a big straw hat on, it kind of probably goes up a couple inches on it. Now, pop-up tents on sets are like these four-legged tents that you pop up, put crafty gear underneath. I would walk into them constantly, so the front of my straw hat had a massive hole in it. So I feel for that stormtrooper who hit his head, because everyone saw it, and they're like, what's the hole up front? I'm like, I just walk into stuff. And now I got a hole in my front of my hat from just walking into things.
I believe it. Again, that stuff just happens.
Yep. But I just still would have loved to have been in the theater going, I think he just hit his head on something.
Like, I mean, they should have more of those real life things happen where, like, you know, like your heroes are just, the Avengers are just walking on a rooftop, like ready to get into their Avenger jet, and like Iron Man just trips.
Yeah. This like scuffs his foot a little bit. Yeah.
It's just a little kind of like that half stumble, and then you look back to see what you tripped on, and you don't see anything there, and you're like, and you look at someone like, you saw there was something there, and they're like, whatever.
Yeah. Like, that's why I like Jack Burton so much.
He's tripping on everything.
Yeah.
you're just surprised when he doesn't trip.
Or you could go the wrong way and you make those movies where, like, I love the movie Evolution, but Julianne Moore is such a klutz in that movie. It's like, whoa.
Wait, I have an aside of that aside. So we've been seeing in social media in the last several days that they're saying that Dwayne The Rock Johnson's Big Trouble in Little China is a continuation of the original Big Trouble in Little China. Do you know if that's official or if that's a rumor?
No, he hasn't said it yet. That's just what somebody else said, I think. They're like, yeah, we got something locked down. You know, I'm a 36-year-old man. Movies have been remade since the dawn of time. Nosferatu was ripped off. Like, you know, The Great Train Robbery, when the first movies had like four similar movies the following year. So remakes are nothing new. But I do not want Dwayne Johnson playing Jack Burton, because Jack Burton, you need selflessness. You need to be the dork. You need to be the, like, believable.
Like, maybe he was infected with the T virus and now he has his nemesis body.
Oh, brother. Just like, I don't know how he's going to do it. Like, can he be not self-conscious about it and just be like a dork and let other
Jumanji.
People save the day?
Jumanji.
Yeah, but the whole time he's like flexing his pecs and like he's making fun of how big he is. But he's not like, because he's in a body of a kid. I just want to see a normal Dwayne Johnson.
Normal Dwayne Johnson. Did you see Skyscraper? How was he in that?
I haven't watched it.
Oh, but we do know that he jumps like 50 feet with a single leg.
Yeah, 12 million feet. All right. Where are we at?
Okay. Right. We have enough back asides to put the branches on a tree. Like, it's
back it up. But bag it up.
I feel like we are basically getting ourselves, like I said, not a whole lot really happens in this movie, but the big thing is they get out of their prison building.
Yeah, so they get out and they go to the ship.
They break out of prison with the prison break guy.
Yeah, but he has tattoos all over him. No, they just take them a genie's map.
What if they just had him take off his shirt? They'd been like, oh, that's how they did it.
Yep. He's been doing that when he's been in his Hannibal Lecter cell. So they, Claire, Chris, and Alice get out and they go to this huge boat, huge, huge, huge boat. And they find out that they're doing human studies. They find Kmart from the third one. They get her out.
Dude, the interior of this boat, this huge research vessel looks like, I mean, just imagine the five coolest ship interiors you saw in the new Star Wars movies or the old remastered Star Wars movies. Like, this is that level of immaculate scale awesome.
Oh, it looks beautiful. And Paul W.S. Anderson wanted it to look like what THX-1138 in 2001. He wanted massive cavernous interiors that were all white. But the problem is, when you work on a white surface, any footstep scuffs it. So they literally had to wait for paint to dry during these scenes to paint over scuff marks.
Interesting. So they're all wearing black boots and shit, right?
Yeah, they painted this cavernous area because you have all the crew, you have lights, people don't listen. You're supposed to have booties on, but people don't put the booties on, or people wear the booties. They go walk outside to Crafty, they get crap on the bottom of their booties, and they walk back on set, and then they track in crap. I've seen it. I hate it. But it happens all the time. And so, beautiful interior, though. You're right, man. I love the look of this boat. And, you know, Anderson, this was a huge pain in the ass for them to shoot and light. Well, no, they said it was pretty easy to light because they just did a big grid above of it. But they had to paint sets. They had to wait for paint to dry. And I think the vision pays off. It looks good. It's like, a very good-looking boat.
In the entire Resident Evil franchise, I'm going to say that it's those shots where I think that he managed to recapture a bit of his vision of scale that we loved so much in like the opening shots of Event Horizon.
Yeah. And he just doesn't have the money to do it. Like, these movies are $50 million budgeted, and that's pretty good, but you got to, like, people are, well, $50 million, but if you, Ant-Man and the Wasp is $200 million. So you got to really.
Yeah. And that's like the runt of the hero movies.
Yeah, exactly. And you got to just, you know, so you pitch your pen. He did a beautiful set. They end up on this boat, and they find out that Wesker is there, and that the serum is taking his body over, and he has to eat people to get fresh DNA to maybe potentially fight off.
Which he announces to them.
I eat bodies. And then he goes to Alice, and he's like, listen, I need to ingest you.
Exposition dump, yeah. Alice.
Lots of monologuing. Lots and lots of monologuing.
But if I eat you and consume you, I'll have the DNA that I need to fend off the virus that's trying to take over me. And then he, like, his head twitches like it's biting him.
And he does look like Val Kilmer in these scenes. I put Val Kilmer look-alike. That was my note
for
him.
And he dodges bullets like a mix of Doc Hollywood and Neo.
Yeah, he is just dodging bullets.
He is Agent Smithing his way around these bullets. And this is the scene where they are hiding the least to the fun they are having with the Matrix.
Like, during the commentary, I just wanted Anderson to once be like, this is my homage to Matrix.
But did they not say Matrix once?
No. He just said, you know, like, slow motion hasn't been done very much lately, so that's why I did it. And I'm like, just say the Matrix. Just say it.
Just say it.
Say it.
Say it. Say it.
If he would have been like, oh, yeah, this is, you know, the Matrix-y, I would have been like, okay, cool.
But did he say, and these are the dogs from Blade 2, if the mouths open wider?
He did break them down, though, and he's like, they're 80% real and then 20% fake. So they had the real dogs on set, and then they augmented them with CGI. No, obviously.
Is this the first truly CGI-like dog effect?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, maybe, yeah, I think I maybe saw one in three when things were blowing up. But yeah, so I mean, but the dogs were there practically on set. They just added the big old weird Blade 2 heads to them. So, of course, Alice isn't like, yeah, you can eat me. She's like, no, you're not going to eat me. And then a battle breaks out where she's fighting the dogs, and then Chris and Claire are fighting Wesker. But Wesker takes the both of them by the scruff of their necks and throws them perfectly into two open tubes.
Right. Those containment units.
Perfectly. Yeah. Like, they land exactly into them. Like, they could have put their arms out, not landed in it, so they get sucked down, so then it becomes just Wesker versus Alice. And then they start fighting, but then Kmart comes back and shoots them. And then Wesker gets into a ship, and he's like, I'm gonna blow y'all up. And then Alice is like, no, we're blowing you up.
Just like in the Event Horizon.
Yeah, she switcheroo'd the bombs, and he blows up, Wesker does, and then I keep saying, Van, they get everyone up, you think it's all great, these people aren't going to be eaten by a madman, but then a shit ton of Umbrella ships come. Were they waiting for Wesker to die?
Dude, there were like, was that hundreds of those giant warships?
Yeah, and I feel like they were waiting for Wesker to die.
Like, he was their crazy – it's like, we are now – Wesker has gone crazy. We need to handle him, but let's see if Alice can handle him first, and then we'll handle Alice. You think that's what they were doing?
I think so, because they came immediately when he died.
It was like when you wait for what was it? It's both like the end of Van Damme's The Quest and the new Godzilla. You wait for the two big bad things to fight each other so that the winner will be tired.
Yeah, and takes a nap. So you have all these humans. You're like, yay, the world's saved. And then Jill Valentine with the spider on her chest is like, we got to take out Alice.
Post-credit stinger in her blue latex jumpsuit.
Yeah, and so she's back. And that's going to lead us into the next one. So, I mean, like, I know we've kind of been bagging.
And at the end, doesn't it use the exact words like, war is coming?
Yeah, something like that.
You in the sequel with 100 warships.
There will be retribution.
Oh. dropping that subtitle.
Holy crap.
Dropping that subtitle.
Wait, so I'm looking at retribution right now, and I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 8... 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, I see 16. Yeah, there's hundreds of those ships coming towards them. And she has to battle Jill. And I mean, those people won't be eaten. I know we were making fun of this movie, John, but this is my favorite out of all of them, I think.
It's probably the most fun.
Yeah, because
that's really easy to say.
I got kind of tired of the first one. The more I watch the first one, the more I'm like, oh. Like, if I had watched all these once, I would have said the first one's the best. Does that make sense?
No, see, I used to think the first one was the best, and the more times I go through, I start to like some of the movies that I was poo-pooing, you know, the first and second viewing. And now I've seen all these movies we've discussed no fewer than three times each.
So, yeah, I'm right now I'm going 4-1-3-2. That's my ranking.
I could go 4-3-1-2, I think.
What do you think about Umbrella, John?
I mean,
what's their goal?
Well, this whole movie, I feel like we were really observing Wesker's goal in the wake of the apocalypse.
Oh.
Because I don't think that he properly represented Umbrella anymore in this movie. I mean, he's going and infecting himself. He's doing a lot of cowboy shit.
Got it.
You know, whereas all the previous movies, they're like, we need to recover Alice. Alice is the key to a lot of things. And in this, she still kind of is, but he's just like, I'm going to consume her. It's like, why don't you just capture her and get a couple drops of her blood?
Why can't they be friends with Alice?
Well, I think Alice just wants them all dead.
But it wasn't.
Why does Alice want them all dead?
But it wasn't their fault, because it was Homeboy's fault in the first one for doing
James
it.
James Purefoy.
Like, Umbrella did not unleash that incredibly dangerous toxin in a breakable glass tube into a poorly ventilated area. Like, Homeboy did it.
If we were to look at Dr. Isaac's motivation in the following movies, not this one, because he's not in it. He was killed at the end of part two.
Part three.
But if we were to look at his actions, though, it seems that either A, after the events of part one, Umbrella quickly recalibrated their interests and found a new greater interest and motivation in Alice. Or what if James Purefoy, I can't remember the character's name in part one, who propagated the whole incident in part one, what if he was actually kind of supposed to do that?
That's why they made it so poorly ventilated and the glass tube so easily breakable?
What if that was planned, and it's really more the PR aspect or just how things look, so that they aren't implicated in trying to become a virological superpower, but this is the way to become a virological superpower?
Because they kind of knew that their technology might get out because people are snooping into them, right? So they go on the offensive and just unleash it.
Right. I'm just saying, like, maybe this is one of those things that's like, you know, where someone wants to lay waste to the world so that they can rule a smaller, more controlled sized world.
But then it just goes terribly out of control.
Right. Well, and this is the movie where the wheels seem to be falling off, right? Because Dr. Isaacs, he at least wanted to think he was on the right path in part three.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to think he was maybe. What if his research went better? You know, a few tweaks on the chemical composition of whatever he was doing. What if he could have made it work?
Yep, he could have made it work.
I don't know what the world would look like then, and he wouldn't have weird like rigid tree root hands.
Very strong shoulders
that turn into tentacles and big shoulders. Lots of traps. The bad guys always have disproportionately huge traps, don't they?
Yeah.
Thick necks.
So you think maybe Purefoy did it. It went out of control. But wouldn't they want to team up with Alice now and be like, listen, we messed up. Wesker's dead. Isaacs is dead. Purefoy's dead. The Red Queen was actually trying to do her job. The other little thing helped you. Just send us a vial of your blood. Like, just, you don't even have to come in. Just send us a vial of blood every month. Just help us out, because we're really trying to get a handle on this.
It's like, what's the worst that'll happen?
Right?
What's the worst that'll happen? What if Wesker was like, just give me a drop of blood so that I can control this? Like, what if afterwards he was like, oh, thanks. Like, my T-virus roid rage is gone. I'm not angry and malicious anymore. Let's go solve some world problem. probably not going to happen. But I mean, everything is so extreme. It's like, we will battle to the death and I'm going to eat you.
Hey, can I get some of your plasma?
Right. You can even have the red blood cells back. I just want the plasma.
Listen, you can leave this base in America, Alice, but just please leave some vials of your blood and we'll come pick it up.
I mean, what if he just punched her really hard and then licked his knuckles?
Oh my god.
Like, what happens? Like, what happens? Is that, what is it? Like, what, well, why do you need to eat so much? This is a virus taking hold and self-replicating. So it really doesn't matter if you eat a steak worth of Alice, all of Alice, or have, like, a sip.
Yeah.
It's not, it's like getting a cold. You don't get heaping spoonfuls of influenza. You're exposed to a few particles, and then they replicate. It's like, why do we need to eat her?
I would just be like, listen, if I go full bad, it's going to be bad. But if you just
if you go full bad.
Just give me some of your blood. We still can hate each other, but you won't have to deal with a full bad me. And then we can do our own thing. You know what? I'll stay in Tokyo, even though you blew up that base. I'll go to Russia. You can take wherever you want. We'll just stand on a horse and kill some zombies.
Yeah. This movie does – well, these movies, they always tell us what the major, like, research goal is, but they don't actually tell us Umbrella's motivation ever, do they?
Never.
Like, my hypothesis is they want to be a virological superpower. Like, if Kim Jong-un had access to the T-virus instead of a few nuclear warheads.
But then it just went terribly wrong for him, correct? Is that what you're saying?
Right, right. But I'm just saying, like, I think that – I feel like they want to – run the world with virological war power.
Got it.
But they don't tell us that.
Yeah.
Right? They've never told us.
Give me a sentence.
Like it doesn't take much. Yeah, you do exposition of, I need to eat you so that I can control this virus that's fighting me. Head twitch. It's like, just, what? And so that I can kill those people with an umbrella who are stupid because they want to rule the world to do flippity floppy. Give me those. It takes me 4 seconds.
Yep, Charlize Theron, she wanted a sub so she could hold people accountable. Cool.
That's just it. Yeah. Even though it was like a lot of people kind of criticized it was so basic, but I kind of like that Bond villainy kind of idealism to it.
All you have to have is a reason.
But you gave me something.
Yeah.
She gave us something. Call it ridiculous or love it, but you have something. We don't know what's going on. Are there other Alice equivalents in other parts of the world that are fighting other facets? Are there people who are running the other facilities who are Wesker-esque, who are also turning into monsters and fighting their clones at their subunit, which maybe isn't even Alice-like? What if it's Michelle Rodriguez? What if they're Rain clones over there? What if they, you know, it's well, what's going on in this world? We don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Retribution will tell us. I mean, we've seen it in the past. I don't remember it well enough to remember what they really identify in it, but
I haven't watched it in 6 years. I've seen it once.
I've seen it twice. I saw it in theaters. I saw it last year when I did the series again. And
I'm excited.
And by the way, for our listeners, the final movie actually does reveal a lot.
Oh, does it?
Oh, yeah. The final movie, the final chapter, that actually gives you some serious exposition dump of, hey, guys, let's wrap all this stuff together.
Okay, good. Because that's why I'm not watching the ones ahead of us. So I'm not like, I don't want us to get to the last one. So
that was my warning. Yeah, because things are it's like now we're seeing Sienna Guillory again. Like we're going to start seeing some characters again.
All right.
That we haven't seen for a while. And,
Go for it.
So it's like that is the danger of seeing them all and then talking about them one by one, because again it's like it starts to become a blur of who is in which movies.
All of our questions will be answered,
and your listener questions if you send some.
Yeah, we need more. I think we've worn out everybody with these questions here.
You know, this is interesting because I think it's because even if you've seen all the Resident Evil movies, you know, once each in theaters or on TV, or you rented it at some point, right? Even if you saw them once each, they don't stick well in your head. They're like they're a blur. People are like, I don't know if I saw that one or not. It's.
I was convinced there were 7 of them, and they're all directed by one guy.
I was kind of with. Well, he wrote them all. Yeah. Though. You were on the right track, and he directed most of them, right? Because he did all but 2.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Yeah. 4. Yeah.
Yeah, he did 4 out of the 6. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, and they wrote the other 2 and produced them. So, I mean, he did, you know, 93% of everything.
And he married the star. I think that's a mulligan for not directing one of them.
Yeah, there we go. It's a gimme.
And he did Event Horizon, so I'll forgive him for the other 2.
Yeah, just Pompeii.
Oh, my God. Wait, hold on. At this point, we have now discussed as full episodes of the podcast, five movies that Paul W.S. Anderson directed and or wrote.
I mean, he did Soldier, too. We got to get there eventually.
Oh, Soldier.
That's a Paul W.S. Anderson joint.
Mortal Kombat.
Yep, Mortal Kombat, Bro Ninjas, Pompeii.
Did you say Bro Ninjas?
Bro Ninjas in Mortal Kombat. Three Musketeers, I love. It's bonkers town. It's one of the... I don't know if I want to watch it again, because I don't think it'll be as crazy as I remembered it. I just remember Orlando Bloom with big hair overacting, and Mila Jovovich falling out of a ship as a human and surviving. Like, from a mile out. Like, she just, like, deuces. She jumps off a ship and just lives. Mila.
I would hope that if I jumped off a ship, I'd live.
I'd just explode. I get caught by a giant eagle because I'm in Middle Earth. All right. So do you have any plugs? Any plugs, John?
The people who usually have our backs, you know, Johnny Numb and Billy Crash from The Last Knock and Crash Palace Productions. They have our back all over Twitter and Facebook. And I love listening to them just about weekly.
Nice. Thanks, Tom. For the questions. Thanks,
everyone. Buddy. That's right.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Also, head to Movies, Films, and Flicks on iTunes, FLIX.com, or FLIX. Rate, review, subscribe to the pod, head to the website, head to Twitter, check out our articles, listen to our podcast. If you listen to this Resident Evil and you haven't listened to the other three, I definitely recommend you listen to those. We also have 142 other episodes you should check out. Enjoy, and thanks for listening. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for John Levengood, have a great night.